Welcome to this podcast of sermons from University Christian Church, Disciples of Christ in Fort Worth, Texas. UCC is a community of faith where all are welcome, where we worship in a spirit of togetherness, where we embrace curiosity, community, and compassion. We don't claim to have all the answers, nor do we expect you to check your brain at the door, but rather we gather together to find the courage to engage the scriptures and to ask the big questions about who we are as people of faith, and who God is calling us to be. At UCC, we seek the sacred, commit to love, and empower to serve. And in so doing, we work together to transform the world through Christ's courageous love. My name is Reverend Dr. Russ Peterman, and I'm the senior minister here at UCC, and so most of these sermons are from me. Well, I want to invite you to turn with me to Luke chapter 20 in the Pew Pocket Bibles in front of you this morning. It's there where we will find the lectionary text for this morning. And I was came to the realization this week in preparing for this sermon that I have never, in over 25 years of ministry, preached on this text before. It is, as you will hear, a bit of an interesting text. It raises all sorts of questions. And it's one, too, that needs a little bit of introduction to help set the context so we can fully understand what we're about to encounter. Where we pick up the story in Luke's gospel, Jesus is already in Jerusalem, just a few days before the Passover, which means it's just a few days before his arrest and eventual trial. In other words, Jesus' time with us is coming to an end. Our time with Jesus is short and precious. Now, you may remember that when he arrived in Jerusalem, that multitudes of people greeted him there. They waved palm branches and they shouted, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." Now, we remember and reenact that every year on Palm Sunday. And when he enters the city, he goes straight to the temple. He goes straight to the temple not to worship, not to pay homage, but to drive those who are selling sacrifices off of its premises. And for the rest of the time there, for the rest of his life, essentially, he takes up residence in the temple, teaching day in and day out, while his opponents look for the opportunity and the means by which to kill him. Now, there was a group of Jews called the Sadducees, and they were similar to, but yet rivals of, the Pharisees. And even though the Sadducees were rivals to the Pharisees, which was another sect of religious leaders of the day, they were united, both the Pharisees and the Sadducees, in their opposition to Jesus. Now, the main difference, though, between those two sects were theological. The Sadducees, you see, recognized only the first five books of the Bible, what we oftentimes refer to as the Torah, the books of Moses, as being authoritative. And because in the Torah, in those first five books of the Bible, it never mentions the resurrection of the dead, the Sadducees didn't believe in resurrection. That's going to be an important part. So just hang on for just a minute. The Sadducees filled various social and political and religious roles, but most importantly, they were the ones that maintained the temple. And remember that Jesus had just caused a scene in the temple. He had driven out the money changers and essentially attacking the sacrificial practices, and so no wonder they didn't like him. So like I said, they began to look for a reason and an opportunity to get rid of him. And they began by trying to goad him into an argument, to try and discredit him, to get him to say something that is heretical. And they do this by bringing up this law that comes from Deuteronomy 25. And that law takes issue with what is known as the levirate marriage. Now, the term from the Latin lever, which means brother-in-law. And this law sought to ensure the preservation of one's family names by stipulating, get this, that a man should marry the childless widow of his brother. Are you with me? So if my brother's wife dies and they have no children, I am bound, I am obligated to marry her and to care for her. Now, trying to goad him into this argument, they ask him a hypothetical question that has to do with this law regarding levirate marriage.
Our gospel lesson this morning is from Luke 20, verses 27 to 38. Some Sadducees, those who say there is no resurrection, came to him and asked him a question. Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies, leaving a wife but no children, the man shall marry the widow and raise up children for his brother. Now there were seven brothers. The first married and died childless. And then the second and the third married her, and so in the same way, all seven died childless. Finally, the woman also died. In the resurrection, therefore, whose wife will the woman be? For the seven had married her. Jesus said to them, those who belong to this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are considered worthy of a place in that age and in the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage. Indeed, they cannot die anymore because they are like angels and are children of God, being children of the resurrection. And the fact that the dead are raised, Moses himself showed in the story about the bush, where he speaks of the Lord as the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now he is God not of the dead, but of the living, for to him all of them are alive. Here ends the reading, the word of God for the people of God.
So do you see now why I have never preached on this text in 25 years of ministry? What is going on here? I have to be honest with you that I almost called in sick this morning. But I didn't think that would go over too well. So here are the Sadducees, one of the powerful parties in the Jewish religious hierarchy. These learned men who are members of the branch of Judaism that doesn't believe in resurrection after death. They've wanted to trap Jesus. They think maybe they can get him to say something heretical. And so they asked him this question about marriage and resurrection. If one of seven brothers marries this woman, he has no children, and then he dies. And as you know, they say the custom, the law was for one of his brothers to marry that widow to make sure that she's cared for. We all know this, right? And then the same thing happens to him. No children and death. Now, all seven brothers married this widow and all met with the same fate. You guessed it. No children, death. And this seven-time widow eventually dies herself. And now comes the perplexing question. In heaven, whose wife of the seven is she? Now, Jesus reflects for a moment before answering. Now, I have to say that if I were Jesus, I would have begun my answer by saying, you know, you would have thought by the time the fourth brother dies that the rest of them would have thought twice before marrying her. Now, I said that at the 9 o'clock service, and after the service, someone came up and said, I just want to be clear, there's not a woman alive that would marry seven different men. It's hard enough to train just the one. But instead, he reminds them that God is the God of the living and not the dead. He's basically saying our concern should be about the living and not the dead. Now, let me back up a little bit because I want to focus more on the Sadducees' question more than Jesus' answer. Because here they are, they're standing before Jesus, the anointed one. Some thought that he was the next Moses. There were others that thought that he was Elijah. And most were coming to see and to believe that he was indeed the Messiah. And yet, that's the best question that they can ask? That's the best that they can do? Now, there's an old Jewish saying that says, rake the muck this way, rake the muck that way, it's still muck. Meanwhile, the saying says, we could be stringing pearls for heaven. I love that. Rake the muck. Rake the muck, but it's still muck. Meanwhile, we could be stringing pearls for heaven. Isn't that great? Because we could be stringing pearls for heaven, but instead, we are continually raking the muck. In other words, how much time do we spend? How much energy do we waste majoring in the minors? Focusing on our attention on things that ultimately aren't that big of a deal. How much of our energy and time and our efforts do we give to things, to questions that ultimately aren't that important? How much time do we spend playing word games? How much time do we waste staring at our phones instead of looking around and seeing the Christ that is right in front of us? I think all too often that we follow in the footsteps of the Sadducees, and we get caught up in silly questions and trivial issues and in theological debates on things that ultimately may not make that big a difference. And in the process, we miss out on the bigger message, the true meaning of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, this summer, I read a book by Sal Bellow. It's a novel. And I read it with my book group, and thank God we got together at the end to talk about it, because full transparency, I didn't get it. It's a classic. It went right over my head. I don't know exactly what I was reading, but there was one part where the main character said, I had boasted how I had loved reality. But unreality, that has been my scheme for a troubled life. I wonder if we are honest with ourselves, if that's not our scheme as well. Do we avoid the reality of questions that ultimately really matter and pay attention to things that don't? Karl Barth, the great 20th century theologian, once said, "The Bible gives to every person and to every era answers to their questions as they deserve. We shall always find in it as much as we seek and no more." We shall find in the Bible every answer to the question that we deserve, and we find it as much as we seek, but yet no more. In other words, church, if we ask small questions, we'll only get small answers. I think in some ways that our small questions are one of the ways that we keep Jesus at arm's length. It's one of the ways that we play Trivial Pursuit, because maybe we're afraid that if we engage with Jesus, if we encounter the living Christ, that's going to cause us to change the way in which we live. It's going to require us to reformulate the way in which we see the world. And it's just easier, isn't it, if we just stay the way we are? We do that with other people, don't we? I would say that we do almost all the time. We like to argue, we like to debate, we like to discriminate so that we know who's on our side. We like to surround ourselves with people who think like we do, who believe like we do, who cheer for the same team, who worship, who vote the same way that we do. In some ways, it's part of the way that we keep ourselves safe. Because if we can surround ourselves with people that are just like us, and if we can watch the news that reinforces our own biases, then we never need to be challenged. We never need to consider that maybe there's another way to look at things. Maybe even we may not be right. Now, it's pretty clear to me that Jesus has no time in the Gospels for those who merely want to play games. Jesus has no patience for those who want to trick him or use him to prove how smart or righteous or perfect they are. Usually those who waste his time, they don't come off very well either. In fact, if right after this exchange, if we were to keep reading a couple of verses, it says, and they no longer dared to ask him any more questions. But on the other hand, Jesus always had time for questions that are real. He always had time for those who were stringing pearls for heaven, because it's those questions that are deep in our hearts that lead us into a deeper relationship with him. Jesus always had time for questions like, can you heal my child? I have a demon that torments me and I can't find any rest. Can you help me? I've lost my way in the circle of life. Can you help bring me back? Point me in the right direction. No one will come close to me because they say that I'm unclean. Can you really love someone like me? You see, when people offer these types of questions to Jesus, the answer that he gives is not some silly slogan or soundbite. No, the answer that Jesus gives in those moments is himself. And when the Sadducees and the Pharisees asked Jesus their trick questions, they oftentimes would get parables, those stories that would leave them scratching their heads, that puzzle their minds, that invite them to look at the world in a new way. But when women and men bring Jesus their deepest yearnings, he doesn't just talk to them. He engages with them. When genuine people come to him with genuine questions, he oftentimes didn't say anything. Instead, he would simply touch them, counter them. He would relate with them. And when he saw that they were sincere, he would invite them to journey with him. Now, you've heard me say that the Latin root of the word question means to seek. It's where we get the word quest. And to ask a real question, a genuine, sincere, honest, heartfelt question, is to enter on a journey. And yet Jesus gets exasperated with the Sadducees because they aren't willing to leave the station. They have no interest at all in seeing things a new way. They just want to play word games. They just want to stay right where they are, believing right what they believe. They may be right, they may be wrong, but the truth is they're just wasting their lives. They're just raking the muck. Do you remember Rilke's book, Letters to a Young Poet? Fascinating book. If you've not read it, I encourage you. There's this aspiring poet from America who writes this famous poet, Rilke, in Germany, with questions about what it means to write poetry. And they began a relationship, a connection. They began to be pen pals over the next 5 years. And in one of his replies, one of the letters to the young poet, Rilke writes, love the questions themselves, as if they were locked rooms or books written in a foreign language. Live the questions now, Rilke says, because perhaps then someday, far in the future, you will gradually live your way into the answer. Love the questions now, and gradually you will live your way into the answer. Some of you remember Scott Colglacier, senior minister here a number of years ago. He said in one of his books, faith, authentic faith, is not so much about collecting answers as it is discovering the essence of spiritual courage. And maybe Christians should be defined not by what we know, but by whom we know. Not by the answers that we can give, but by the questions we are courageous enough to ask. Our deepest questions don't have simple answers. Instead, they are doors to walk through. And that's why Jesus says, I am the way, because with him, through him, we live our way into the answers we so desperately seek. And so as a community of faith that lists among its core values things like curiosity, vulnerability, maybe we need to bring our deepest questions to Jesus, questions for which we desperately want answers. Questions like, does God love me as I am? Are we alone? Is the life that I am living the life that wants to live in me? You see, the Sadducees, they can't ask these questions because they think they already know the answers. But real, genuine, authentic questions are doorways to the journey towards new life. We bring these questions to Jesus because we believe that he is the way to new life, that he invites us to see and to think of a new world, a world in which the old rules don't apply. Jesus was constantly inviting us to see the world in a new way, to do things in a new way. And so he invites the Sadducees to lay aside their simplistic questions and to think of a new world in which the living and the dead are connected. And in the same way, Jesus invites us to set aside our simplistic questions that we tend to ask one another, those questions that we ask each other, that keep others at arm's length. You see, we are living in a world, are we not? We are living in a time where we are more fragmented, when we are more divided than in any other time in our memory. And aren't we dying? Aren't we dying as a nation, as a culture, for a new way of living? Aren't our souls craving, desperate for a new way of moving in this world, a way in which the wholeness that God intends for our lives is truly known, is truly discovered, is truly experienced, a way in which we are more connected with each other, in a way in which we are more connected with the divine. And so, church, may we lay aside our silly questions, our trivial pursuits. May we live into the question, that God may do a new thing in us and through us, a new thing in this world. Amen.
So thanks for listening. I do hope and pray that you found this sermon to be engaging and thoughtful and inspiring and maybe even a little challenging. I also hope that if you get the chance to join us on Sunday mornings in our sanctuary, you will. I think you'll find the welcome warm and inviting, the music inspiring, and there will always be a place at the table for you, regardless of who you are, or where you come from, or where you are on your spiritual journey. Just know that you're welcome here. And if you'd like to support the production of this podcast and the ongoing mission and ministry of UCC, or to simply find out more about this community of faith, we invite you to go to universitychristian.org. Grace and peace to you.